Hello and welcome to the Theatre Named London Theatre podcast for the 29th of January 2017. My name's T.R.B. Watson, and this week I'm joined by Johnny Fox, Paul in London, and Gareth James. We're now going to talk about Death Takes a Holiday at the Charing Cross Theatre. This production is directed by Tom Sutherland, who is the artistic director of the Charing Cross Theatre. It is a UK premiere of the musical by Maury Yeston with a book by Peter Stone and Thomas Meehan. It's based on the 1924 Italian play La Morte in Vacanza by Alberto Casella, which was adapted into English in 1929. It was also made into a film in 1934, starring Frederick March, but maybe slightly more familiar to people when it was remade in 1998 as Meet Joe Black, starring Brad Pitt. The story of the musical, which goes back to the original Italian play, is that death takes the form of a handsome young prince. I believe it's just after the First World War, in order to understand human emotion. And the team behind this is the same team that did Titanic at the same theatre last year. John, tell me more about this production and what you thought of it.
I'm going to start by saying the good things about it. It won't take long. With each successive production, what you refer to as the same team, particularly Tom Sutherland, the director, managed to make Charing Cross Theatre, a grim little archway under the railway at Charing Cross, look more and more like a West End house. I always thought this was a tunnel of an auditorium with what looked like a tiny stage. But, you know, hand in hand with his designer, in this case, Morgan Large, he really seems to expand it and to give it the kind of grandeur and the production values that make it look as if it was up the road in Shaftesbury Avenue. And I really congratulate this team on that, because it's a great thing to do, particularly when you're working with imported or unknown material and you are giving it what really feels like its best chance, because I don't think anyone would take the financial risk on a production like Death Takes a Holiday to put it straight into the West End. I think this may be its final resting place, though, because I don't see this as a transferable or mainstream production. Now, as you said, Tim, it is a story in which death is a named character. And, you know, I'm drawn to the phrase, as I think Michael Billington also was when he published about 10 minutes after I did, asking, would we be more half in love with easeful death, which is a quote from Keats, if instead of some cadaver in a cowl with a scythe, he came at us as a handsome young man? And then the other dilemma is, can you love somebody more than life? Now, this is presented almost as soon as he meets the young woman, whose name is Grazia Lamberti. And Grazia, I just kept thinking of that silly women's magazine. Sorry, it came up again and again and again in my head. And he meets her just as she's had a road accident, being rather foolish and standing up in a speeding sports car. And she dies. And, you know, it's a little bit like Ghost, you know, he scoops up the body and decides she's so beautiful and so interesting that he really wants to know more about her, to be close to her, and to discover why human beings fear death so much. So she doesn't die, and he contrives both to save her and spend a weekend at her father's palazzo on Lake Garda. Now, here for me, the concept hits a bit of a tree, because in order to set it in a villa in 1922 and populate it with a lot of characters, Maury Yeston makes what I think is a typical American mistake, and he suffers from, you know, kind of aristocratic penis envy, because everybody apart from the servants is at least a baron, and death himself has to masquerade as a Russian prince. And then I began to think, well, yes, we've all seen a little night music, and unfortunately this is neither as musically elegant nor as plausible. And it's really never explained why a villa in Lombardy just after the First World War, I think it might be about 1922, so quite a bit after the First World War, is quite so rammed with Americans, because they didn't tend to come to Europe in huge numbers in the early 20s. But as far as score is concerned, it looks like Maury Yeston, who is the composer of Titanic and Grand Hotel, which are very theatrical and anthemic, is now flirting with operetta. because this looks and feels a lot of the time like The Merry Widow or something like that. It's got those sorts of Liharian overtones. And it's true that he really loves a grandiloquent melody. And there are some beauties in Death Takes a Holiday, the best of which is a rich and classically lovely romantic duet called More and More, which I thought was delivered with real power and genuine feeling by two leads, Chris Peluso and Zoe Duano. And if you listen to it in the version that the producers put out as a kind of teaser or trailer, where it's only accompanied by the piano, you really will be charmed. It's a nice piece of craft. But unfortunately, in the production, if you listen to it there, you will be mown down by the juggernaut effect of a 10-piece band and these overblown bombastic orchestrations which decorate every single song. And, you know, with key change after key change and crescendo after crescendo, it's like the orchestrations were designed for the 1812 overture, not for a chamber musical in a small theatre. And even in the good songs, there are horsey lyrics. There's a lovely moment where Catherine Aitken, you know, famously the understudy to Leslie Garrett in Carousel, who did more performances than Garrett herself did. She plays Duchess, of course, Stephanie, and sings movingly of her aviator son who was killed in action during the war. And she sings, "He sat at his window, stared at the moon, wrote in his diary, played bassoon," at which the entire audience erupts because it's so preposterously stupid. Because you could count the number of bassoon playing noble-born North Italian aviators on the fingers of a one-armed navigator bomb aimer and still have five spare. You know, why couldn't he just have hummed a tune? It would have fit the music. And I don't understand why Yeston doesn't have a better collaborator, because I think he's vain enough to write music and lyrics himself and really needs a bit of help. However, among the senior batty aristocrats is the wonderful gay soper. She's playing a sort of grandmotherly part, rather like Hermione Gingold in Gigi, and twinkling effortlessly at the audience. She has a few pithy jokes and lines, but she plays a character, again, which strikes me as slightly under-researched. She's the Contessa di San Daniele. And I'm fairly sure that Paul, who spends quite a lot of time in Italy, can tell us that it must be a naughty coincidence that San Daniele is a type of very long matured old ham.
Delicious too.
Well, yes. Well, there you go. Then it is gay.
Just like gay.
She is a long matured old ham who gives a delicious performance. And she tells this scurrilous tale about losing her virginity in the back of a gondola, like we haven't all been there. And then there's this wholly unnecessary, but really, really delightful duet with Anthony Cable, who plays her doctor, who's also her affectionate suitor. And it's another one of those lovely, lovely, adorable pictures of late love. So there's a lot to like about it, but it just didn't, it was overblown in some senses. I thought it had beautiful lighting and costuming and set and great singing and good performances, but it still didn't make either a musical that could appeal to a contemporary audience or a classic musical of that sort of Rodgers and Hammerstein genre that would stand alone for many years to come. But Gareth, why don't you tell me what you thought about it?
Well, I think I agree with a lot of what you said, really. I mean, you have to differentiate between the production and the show, I think. And the production, as we've kind of become used to now from Tom Sutherland and his team, is really very good. I loved Morgan Large's design. It's a kind of a terrific fading Italian villa that sort of fills the stage, which I thought was excellent. And I think Jonathan Lippman's costumes were, you know, his period costumes were also very, very good. I didn't find the sound, the orchestral sound, as offensive as you did. I found it sort of quite lush, really, and in keeping with the material. Because I do think it's quite a nice melodic score. It's not a great score, but it's a nice melodic score. When I was kind of thinking about it, it kind of that does make you feel a bit like A Little Night Music, although not as good a score, but also like Sondheim's Passion. It's in that kind of territory. And I think Americans are kind of quite drawn to that kind of territory, and we're perhaps a little bit more cynical about musical theatre treatment of those sort of things, really. But it is...
I think you're right. I think you're very right about Americans' perception of things set in Europe. And I think this suffers from the same problems as The Light in the Piazza, that was very appealing to American audiences, but we didn't get it because perhaps we're closer to what Italy's really like.
Yeah, and I don't think we got... I mean, I don't think Passion is probably sometimes weakest show, not necessarily because of the score, but again, because of the treatment of this sort of European material, really. I too thought Gay Soper almost stole the show, and her proper title, by the way, is the Contessa Evangelina di San Daniele. So you forgot the Evangelina there from the name. And actually, you know, she's almost now 50 years in musical theatre. And you have to say, you know, if you've been in musical theatre 50 years and you're turning in cameos like that, well, that's a kind of Olivier special award, I'd say. But I did think Zoe Duano and Chris Peluso were very good in the leading roles. And they are surrounded by, you know, a very good ensemble. The servant Fedeli, who's played by James Grant, he's actually going to be promoted to the role of Death doing the run, apparently.
James Gant.
Oh, well. My apologies to James Gant. Well, for me, I mean, I like Murray Estin's shows. You know, I did like Titanic and I did like Phantom, which he did with Arthur Coppett and Grand Hotel in the last production, Ticklow. But I left the theatre thinking, why did you write this? I really just thought it was a misguided idea to turn this story into a musical. And I couldn't engage with I couldn't suspend enough disbelief, frankly, to engage with the story. And that, in the end, is the problem for me. I'm not convinced by the premise or the story, and therefore I can't really engage with it. So that's where I am. Paul, where are you?
Well, that's actually interesting. I was actually describing this show after seeing it, and I could actually describe the plot of it quite well, but I couldn't quite come to, you know, recall any of the music for me. And actually, I think the reason being, I think I really liked this story much more than the musical. And I think it is, I think, what John referred to and some other critics also referred to. It is the ideas about, you know, the concept of death, being tired after the First World War and wanting to experience life and humanity comes in a human form. And I think that was, for me, that was, you know, the endless possibilities in a theatrical sense to actually tell this story. And, you know, it was quite interesting. I think in the execution, I think, as you've said, the American perception of Europe gets in the way, as usual. Perhaps the reason why there are so many Americans in Lake Garda is perhaps it's due to the prohibition, because that was happening at the same time. But none of that's mentioned. So we just have to assume that, you know, Americans are everywhere. But actually, I think their intention was to create this chamber musical after doing something big, because I think he collaborated with the same book writers for Titanic, and they wanted to do something smaller scale. And on that level, I think it does succeed. It works really well in the Charing Cross Theatre. I love the space. I love the production. I love the cast. I thought they did a tremendous service. But the endless Gothic orchestrations, I actually felt that was overblown. And actually, you know, this production probably could have gotten away with just two pianos to actually cover the music, and it actually would have been a completely different experience. And we might have forgiven some of the cheesier lyrics of Mr. Yeston's, and perhaps some of the more obvious musical flourishes that he seems to go for in this. But I too was also thinking of Passion. I think, John, when we were seeing it, you were thinking of the Pensione from the review of which Sondheim review was it? Oh no, it was his collaboration with
Roger's thing, because that's set in or near Venice, isn't it? With a lot of Americans.
Yeah. So on one level, I think I really enjoyed this, because actually it's a new musical. It's another one of Mr. Yeston's works, and I too quite admire his work as a composer. But on the other level, I think the music really was jarring and actually put me off enjoying the show. Later in the week, I saw Dreamgirls, which is another fully blown, fully fledged musical, which, you know, everything about it is big and loud. And I think that works there. But here, I was hoping for something a little bit more subtle, and you don't get that in the orchestrations. And that, I think, is a real shame. And it's probably one of the few times you could walk out of the theatre going, oh, it's a shame about the orchestrations in that respect. But, you know, you cannot fault the cast. There's some beautiful singing that's happening across the piece, but particularly with Chris Peluso and Zoe Duano. It'll be interesting to see what James Gant does with the role as well. He steps in as the role of Death from the 13th of February. So depending on when you're listening to this, you may have a different guise of Death. But all told, it's a curiosity that I think musical theatre fans might want to go and see.
In a great coincidence, I was actually at Dreamgirls the night after I went to see Death Takes a Holiday. And in fact, I was at School of Rock the night before. So this was a sort of really interesting sandwich. The contrast between the other two shows and this was quite striking.
I could imagine, yes.
And the bling of Dreamgirls, well, my man, well.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, you don't get quite so much bling here, but I think it's not required. And I think it's simply staged and it works quite well.
We're now going to talk about Wishlist by Catherine Soper. This is a play about a young woman who is on a zero-hour contract packing boxes at a warehouse. It looks very much like a well-known firm that sends lots of packages out to people, but of course isn't. She looks after her brother, who is housebound. He is very obsessive-compulsive. He constantly puts hair gel on and is trying to always adjust his hair. He has a terrifying compulsion about boiling water and whether water's boiled enough, and so he really can't come out, but he has been counted fit for work by various people, mainly because when he was interviewed he was intimidated enough to pretend not to be ill, it appears. At the packing plant, Tamsin befriends one of her co-workers who went to school with her brother and also has a kind of interesting relationship with her supervisor, who is as trapped by, you know, this zero-hour contract situation as she is. And it's not, it paints a picture which we kind of get the impression of when we read about zero-hour contracts, that they really are deeply, deeply unpleasant. I mean, it's very much as if it's all been time and motion studied, so there are no gaps really for relaxing, for sort of taking a couple of minutes. You've got to constantly be working. If you need to go to the bathroom, if you need to go to the toilets, you're going to have to sprint. And if you go to the wrong toilets, you're going to spend too long there. Things like your phone and other things are locked away in lockers, but the warehouse is so vast that by the time you get back to your locker, you probably don't have enough time to eat lunch as well. There's lots of things like that, and you know, the inherent criticism of the zero-hour contracts, which are something that are a major problem, I think. And this talks about them, but I think it also tells this very powerful story of this brother and sister, and again, the way that some of the people in government have been, you know, trying not to pay anybody, trying not to have to, you know, look after people in the way that they should, you know, the way that they have introduced their point systems and have convinced the people applying the point system to whether or not you get certain disability benefits to try to make sure that they give out as few disability benefits as possible. And this, in many ways, deals with the consequence of that, but also, you know, it is about other things as well. Now, Catherine Soper won the Bruntwood Prize for playwriting in 2015. I'm not sure if it was actually this play or another one of her previous works. Gareth, tell me more about this production, what you thought of it.
Well, I found this a very, very impressive piece of new writing, and it was good to be in the Royal Court upstairs witnessing it. It's actually, as you say, juxtaposing sort of two current sort of social issues, really. One is concerning the benefit system, which I'll come back to, and the other is concerning these zero-hour contracts in warehouses. I mean, we used to have things called factories where people made things, and there were production lines, and people worked there. And of course, now all of that's done outside the UK. We then got call centres, which became the new factories, because we were doing everything by phone. And now what we've got to add to the call centres is we've got these warehouses, because we're buying everything online. And these warehouses are, you know, the new factories, but actually they're more inhumane because you've got zero-hour contracts, so there's no loyalty to the employees. It's measured beyond belief to the point where, you know, it's so rigid, it must be a very inhumane and unpleasant place to work. You know, it's not just this play. I've heard lots of stories and heard lots of experiences of these sort of places. So you've got this new world of work, as it were, juxtaposed with the new world of benefits, the outsourced benefit system, which itself is a production line, which is, you know, inhumane and inflexible, and it's all tick box processes, really. And what you've got is you've got a kind of a unique individual with a unique condition who can't navigate this system. And that's following kind of similar ground, really, to Home at the Dorfman Theatre, we talked about just before Christmas, I think, and also similar ground to Ken Loach's play, I, Daniel Blake. And I thought it did it really well, because it wasn't preachy. It was just kind of presenting us with, you know, with these two situations and moving us between these two situations. The sister looking after her OCD younger brother, and then the sister working in the warehouse with a supervisor who is clearly sympathetic as a character, an East European supervisor, clearly sympathetic, but he's got his hands tied behind his back. I mean, he himself has got to follow these sophisticated measurement systems that he's been given to do. But he does come over as a sympathetic character, you know, because I think he understands her plight. And there's a colleague there who is working before he goes back into education, and another sort of sympathetic character. And I think that those are important extra characters. Luke in particular, the young man who's working with her, there is a kind of little bit of a love interest there that evolves but doesn't really go anywhere. I thought it was a very, very well-written piece, very delicate and I thought very beautiful, if you could say such a thing about writing. I thought the characters were particularly well-drawn. You could really identify with and empathise with the characters. And I thought everything about Matthew Zier's production was sensitive to the material. Four lovely performances. Erin Doherty is Tamsin, the sister, and Joseph Quinn as Dean, her brother. I thought they were fantastic performances. And they've really felt brother and sister. You really kind of felt that these were siblings. And then you had, I hope I get the pronunciation right here, you had Shaquille Ali Yabuha, who was Luke, and Alexander Mikic as the supervisor. And again, very sort of delicate, very nuanced performances. So I was just so pleased to be there in the Royal Court Theatre upstairs, seeing such a nice piece of new writing that was given such a nice, delicate production. What did you think, Tim?
I have to say, I'm, you know, being nasty and cynical, I'm rather proof against this sort of thing, but it did make me feel all the right things in all the right places about this. It is one of those things that makes you very frustrated because you really want to fix this. I mean, I certainly would want to fix, you know, see ways around of fixing this. And the way that you would fix it in the old days, of course, is to unionise, because they would make sure that these poor people who are on contracts and they're all working as contractors. They've all got this, you know, it's all this agency, and it's all distanced between the people and work and the job, so you can't unionize anymore and you can't get a union in to fix things about it. But, you know, these are things that go through my head rather than perhaps worrying too much about, you know, thinking too much about the play. But it was very effectively done. Erin Doherty's character was extremely sympathetic and quite bright. She knew how to get herself out of the situation, but is unable to do anything much else apart from this sort of zero-hour contract, where they get told at the end of the day whether or not they're going to be needed, and then are expected to fulfill massive targets. Nobody really, it doesn't look like anybody expects them to fill, but they use it as a determining factor about whether or not they're going to get work the next day. And it really, this is the thing, I want to fix this. It comes back to that. And again, I think as we discussed with Home, it's not something that we can easily fix, because the people who are going to see this are not the people who have any power to fix things. They can just, you know, protest them.
I think other plays like Home have covered the benefits ground, as it were. But I actually think what Catherine Soap has done is, as far as I'm aware, she's the first person to kind of present this zero hours contract stroke warehouse inhumane jobs thing on stage, and that's one of the reasons I found it.
I do have to correct you there, actually.
Okay.
Alexander Zeldin did this with no.
Oh, he did.
He did. He did exactly this. So, in his previous play, I mean, it was a different setup, and it was much, much more depressing than this one. Because I mean, this one has, you know, great heart in it. But if you thought love was depressing, I can't remember what it was called. Beyond Caring, I think it was called.
So, I didn't see that one, this is the first for me, obviously.
I'm now going to talk about art at the Old Vic Theatre. This is Yasmina Retzer's 1995 play, adapted by Christopher Hampton, and directed now, as it was in 1996, by Matthew Walkus, who is the artistic director of the Old Vic. It stars Rufus Sewell as Serge, Tim Key as Yvonne, and Paul Ritter as Mark. It concerns Serge buying a white painting, not just any white painting, but one with white diagonal lines on it. Serge tries to impress his friend Mark with this painting, which fails, as Mark finds it pointless, and they each try to get their friend Yvonne on side. Yvonne has his own problems, feeling overwhelmed by his upcoming wedding. This play opened initially in the West End in 1996 at the Wyndham Theatre, and starred Tom Courtney, Albert Finney and Ken Stott. Then, over the next 8 years, there was a rotating trios of distinguished actors coming in to play the three different roles. It's something of a bomb-proof play. It's a good play, it works extremely well, and the relationships are well thought out. And you can see these things in this production. You can understand why it was so popular for so many years. The cast here is very good. The relationships that they create are believable and interesting. It's a 90-minute play which goes past in a very entertaining way. Apparently, Yasmina Retzer was rather disappointed when she won an Olivier for this play, as it was for best comedy. She's always considered it something of a tragedy. In many ways, she's right. This is a play about the breakdown of a relationship between these three people. And at the end of the play, the possible way in which they reconcile with each other. We briefly discussed this in our review of the year earlier this year, and it was pointed out that nothing's really changed in this production. And I think that's largely true. And in some ways, it is a bit of a problem. Matthew Walker, of course, is a good director, and he directs this play very well, but it's like having a new cast for the original production with a 12-year hiatus in between. I'm not sure that they really bring anything new to this play. There are one or two things that are new, however. Instead of being a 200,000 all-white painting, it is now a 100,000 euro all-white painting. Also, as we mentioned in the review of the year, our attitudes towards this kind of art in the last 20 years have changed. We don't find the idea of an all-white painting quite so offensive as we used to. I think we're much more accepting of this kind of art, and I was kind of reminded that it's not long ago that we saw the play Red by John Logan at the Donmar Warehouse, where every night you could watch Alfred Molinar as Rothko painting enormous red canvases. But, of course, this is essentially a good production of a good play with good people in it, and you could easily see it moving into a vacant theatre in the West End and spending several years, even 8 years, once again with an ever-rotating cast of actors. I think, though, it is our attitudes to the real art that have changed, and also I can't help feeling that after seeing this play, I would quite like to have seen a production done by a different director, so there was more of a contrast with the past production. You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.